150 years ago tomorrow, Confederates in South Carolina fired the shot that started the Civil War. The single cannon shell that exploded over the federal garrison at Fort Sumter broke decades of tensions over slavery between the North and South. The Confederate attack also ended months of uncertainty for the federal soldiers at Fort Sumter. There had been no orders from Washington during the long siege, except to stay firm. Historian Adam Goodhart is the author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening. He's also one of the main contributors to the special New York Times online Civil War series, Disunion. I asked him to explain that lack of guidance from Washington for the troops at Fort Sumter.
Well, it was a very strange sort of surreal situation. Now, of course, most of the South, the Deep South, had seceded at this point, and South Carolina was the very first state to secede, and Charleston was the epicenter of secession within South Carolina. And then right there in the middle of Charleston Harbor is this little island, this two-acre island, that just happens to have a Union garrison on it, but it could scarcely even be called a military force. We're talking about 60 soldiers, a few officers, and a brass band. And this little fort with this little group of men just became a huge national issue. It was to the South as though they had a foreign military power at the very center of their new nation. So Washington really wasn't sure what to do. On the one hand, there was no military value to this little piece of federal real estate. But on the other hand, it would be a big symbolic gesture if they pulled that garrison out. It would be saying, we are ready to give up federal property. We are ready to let the South take control of its own territory.
And so remind us of some of the figures involved. We can talk about Major Anderson, who was in charge of the folks at Sumter, and then his Confederate counterpart.
Yeah, well, the most interesting thing, you know, the commander of the troops, the Union troops who were in Fort Sumter, sort of besieged by the South, was a man named Robert Anderson, who was actually a Southerner and had Southern sympathies, but he was a good, loyal American Army officer. And so in the end, although people were very concerned about what he might do, that he might simply surrender this fort, in the end, he did decide to stick it out and fight. His opponent, his counterpart on the Confederate side, General Beauregard, G.T. Beauregard, often called P.G.T. Beauregard, was actually, amazingly enough, a former student of Anderson's from when Anderson had been a professor at West Point. So these two men knew each other. They had actually remained friends. And when Beauregard shows up in Charleston to lay siege to Anderson and Sumter, the first thing he does is send across a case of fine brandy and a crate of cigars as a token of his esteem to Major Anderson. And Major Anderson, being a very sort of punctilious officer, promptly sends them back untouched.
And another thing that really jumped out at me here in the book was that there wasn't all this support for Lincoln as president.
That's right. Yeah, Lincoln came into office, and, you know, we think of him as such a wise elder statesman today, but people thought that he was really going to be a sort of a figurehead, as in fact a lot of the antebellum presidents had been, and everyone was very surprised when he stepped up to the plate and sort of took charge of the situation rather quickly.
Right. So, and he had been president for about a month at the point that the war started, and everyone expected at Fort Sumter thought Lincoln was just going to surrender peacefully.
What happened was actually sort of extraordinarily wily on Lincoln's part. He decided to send a relief expedition with supplies down to Fort Sumter.
Because the men were starving.
Because the men were starving at this point. Right. They were down to sort of literally their last little bits of salt pork and hardtack. What Lincoln does is something that perhaps a more experienced military commander wouldn't have done, but that turns out to be a stroke of genius. He telegraphs the Confederates and tells them these ships are coming, that this expedition is coming. Why did Lincoln do this? Well, Lincoln knew that if he couched this not as a military expedition, but simply a humanitarian mission to bring food to these starving men, it would put the Confederates in a very, very difficult spot. They would have to either let the fort be resupplied, or they would have to open fire upon these ships that were just simply peacefully bringing food. Lincoln knew at this point that the war was going to come. he wanted to force the Confederates to make the first move. He knew that it would just discredit them in the eyes of the North, discredit them in the eyes of the rest of the world, and he succeeded brilliantly. It was really Lincoln's first great masterstroke in politics.
Finally, Adam, besides your words, your book also has a lot of words from the poet Walt Whitman, and we're going to hear one of his poems in just a minute, but remind us of his role in the war. Was he sort of like the poet laureate of the conflict?
Whitman really became the poet laureate after the war, because Whitman actually, during the Civil War, published no poetry at all. He was preoccupied with this great national drama, and he was sort of storing up material for as soon as the war was over, when he just had a tremendous, tremendous creative outpouring. But there are wonderful descriptions that Whitman wrote later on of what it was like to be in America at that point when the news of Fort Sumter came. And on the night that the news arrived in New York that the fort had been attacked, Whitman was attending an opera in Lower Manhattan and walked out of the theater. It was around midnight, and immediately notices that something is wrong, something is different. There are newsboys racing through the streets, something you would never see normally at midnight, and they're shouting, "Extra, extra, Fort Sumter attacked." And under each little gaslight street lamp on the streets of Lower Manhattan is a group of men and women gathered, holding open these extra editions of the newspaper and marveling at the news and wondering if it's true. And Whitman says that afterwards the news ran through the land as if an electric shock.
Huh.
So he really sort of captured the mood of the entire nation at that moment.
Adam Goodhart's new book is 1861, The Civil War Awakening. One of Walt Whitman's Civil War poems is called 1861, and it's read here by former poet laureate Robert Pinsky.
Armed year, year of the struggle. No dainty rhymes or sentimental love verses for you, terrible year. Not you as some pale poetling seated at a desk, lisping cadenzas piano, but as a strong man erect, clothed in blue clothes, advancing, carrying a rifle on your shoulder, with well-gristled body and sunburnt face and hands, with a knife in the belt at your side. As I heard you, shouting loud, your sonorous voice ringing across the continent. Your masculine voice, O year, as rising amid the great cities, amid the men of Manhattan I saw you, as one of the workmen, the dwellers of Manhattan, or with large steps crossing the prairies out of Illinois and Indiana, rapidly crossing the west with springy gait and descending the Alleghenies, or down from the Great Lakes, or in Pennsylvania, or on deck along the Ohio River, or southward along the Tennessee or Cumberland rivers, or at Chattanooga on the mountaintop, saw I your gait and saw I your sinewy limbs, clothed in blue, bearing weapons, robust year, heard your determined voice launched forth again and again, year that suddenly sang by the mouths of the round-lipped cannon. I repeat you, hurrying, crashing, sad, distracted year.
That's poet Robert Pinsky reading Walt Whitman's poem 1861. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again. Here and Now.